Splendid blessed day and a warm welcome to the Grillet Cafe brought to you by Frontinus Limited. Frontinus is a communications consultancy focused on engineering, infrastructure and sustainability. With you today is Angie Musa, political scientist and teaching associate at the University of Cambridge. And I'm very pleased as always to be accompanied by Mr. Anthony Haynes, creative director of Frontinus. Greetings, Mr. Anthony.
Greetings, Angie.
In this podcast, we covered various forms of Grey literature, such as blogs, posters, and emails. And in this episode, we turn to another one, which is not usually thought of as part of Grey literature, and this is letters. So, Professor Anthony, how come we are speaking about letters today?
Well, I first had the idea when I was walking through the Museum of Geology in the University of Cambridge, and they had a really fascinating exhibition of based on Charles Darwin. Darwin, of course, was a great scientist, but he realised there were bits of science he didn't know enough about, and so he wrote to world experts and asked them for information and explanations, and they wrote letters back. And there's this exhibition of his letters, his correspondence in the museum, and I thought, that's very interesting. And it made me think about how letters could be thought of as a form of grey literature. And the more I think about it, the more I think that the place of letters and where it fits into the idea of grey literature is actually really important. So what I'm hoping to do, Ingie, is in the over a number of episodes, cover letters quite extensively, because I think there's a lot to be said about them. In particular, I'd like to explore the relevance of the genre of letters to the definition of grey literature. I'd also like to think about letters, particularly with the Darwin example in mind, as precursors to podcasts. In other words, sometimes you read letters and think, well, had they had podcasts, they would have done that as a podcast. And I'm also interested in just establishing the letters as a form of grey literature, just arguing the point that they should be included. So that's what I'd like to focus on today. And it's worth saying here, GreyNet have published on their website, where obviously we'll put the link in the show notes, they've published on their website a list of the document types, typical document types of grey literature. And actually, they didn't include letters. Letters are not included there. Now, in their defence, they've never claimed it's a comprehensive list. It's a list of typical examples, not comprehensive. But it's interesting. I think it was a bit of an omission. So that's one of the things that prompted me to suggest that we should devote some time on the podcast to the topic of letters.
Interesting. Wow. So that's like a bit off script. So before we kind of ask you to share some of the examples so people actually can see how letters fit into grey literature, it's kind of maybe one thing to ask is, why do you think people do not immediately, or like things like GreyNet, for example, again, we agree that it's not a comprehensive list, but why people do not think of letters as a form of literature as a starting point?
I think there's an unresolved question about whether grey literature involves public literature or whether it can include private communications. So I think implicit when people are discussing grey literature and trying to define it, I think implicit is the assumption that it will be in some sense public documents. But I don't know of anywhere where people make that point explicitly. And of course, that raises the question of, even if a letter is written as a private letter, if it then becomes published, say in book form, has it then become grey literature? So isn't it an interesting thing to explore?
That's a fascinating point, like the difference between private and public communication. Wow, that's very fascinating, something to reflect on, definitely. Okay, so thinking of that public part, yeah, for a bit, what would be a good illustration of letters as a form of literature from your own experience?
Well, I've chosen as an example a book called Selected Letters of I.A. Richards, which is a book edited by a man named John Constable. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be presumptuous here, Ingie, and correct me if I'm wrong. My guess will be that the name I.A. Richards isn't familiar to you.
Isn't familiar.
Isn't, yeah.
To be honest, no.
Yeah. And so that partly reflects the fact that we studied in different disciplines, because he was much better known in, I suppose you'd say, the fields of literary criticism and also something like semantics or linguistics. It also reflects the different generations. Like, you know, I was definitely told in 1980 I ought to go away and read I.A. Richards, and I suspect far fewer people are told that today. Anyway, so there's a collection of his correspondence which was published in 1990.
And what particular in this collection like made you think of his letters as a form of gay literature?
Well, it's interesting. It was an introduction to the particular volume I have, written by, I think it's Richard Luckett. And he begins, I'm just going to read the first line. It says, I.A. Richards was not a writer of great letters, though he was, against his will, a great writer of letters. So I think what Luckett means there is there are some people who are just fantastic writers who write in letter form. People like, a lot of them in the 18th century, poets like Thomas Gray and William Cowper. And their letters are works of literature. And I.A. Richards isn't like that. You don't read his letters and think, oh, it's, you know, well, that's wonderfully, that's beautiful, or that's wonderfully evocative, or something like that. So he's not a writer of great letters, but he did write a lot of letters, and it was an important part of his work. And what really made me choose him there was the fact that if you are trying to understand certain key topics in 20th century literature, and especially in 20th century thinking about literature, His letters add little, they don't radically change the picture of things, but they give you a more nuanced understanding of the various debates. And if you were unaware of his letters, so they're quite serious minded, and they're really quite focused on intellectual debates. So a scholar who's only looking at the conventional sources, such as published books about literary criticism and literary theory and so on, would miss out on a bit, I think. They would misunderstand and probably underestimate I.A. Richards as a literary commentator.
I think before we started recording, you mentioned one of his letters on the poetry of Amy Lowell. So
yes,
can you tell us a little bit more about this one?
Okay, this is a good example. I won't read out the whole letter, but I'll read a part of it. It's a letter to the person who actually became his wife in due course. And what's happened is that Dorothea Pilley, her name was at that point, has sent I.A. Richards a pamphlet. And the pamphlet is written by a friend of hers called Winifred Ellerman. And the pamphlet's called Amy Lowell, A Critical Appreciation. This is dated from 1918. And Richards has read the pamphlet, and he wants to have his say about what he thinks about the pamphlet, but in particular, what he thinks of the idea of Amy Lowell as a poet who deserves appreciation. So this is what he says. He says, "Thanks for the pamphlet. I shall use it for negative propaganda." So that's the first thing to say. A lot of literary criticism is positive. Not all of it by any means, but there's a positive bias. People tend to write about the writers who they enjoy and who they want to promote, more so than wanting to just be negative and critical about writers who they don't rate very much. But in I.A. Richards' letters, he's very prepared to be negative. So he says, "I shall use it for negative propaganda. It isn't worthwhile explaining how poor I still think Amy is, and consequently how strange I hold your friend must be. I'm afraid her way of writing about Amy reminds me of the way the guidebooks write about the Menai Bridge and Straits. However, with regard to Amy herself, may I direct your attention, one, to the shocking obviousness of her ideas and themes, two, to the commonplace treatment she gives them, three, the absence of any element of surprise in reading her things, except occasionally when one is forced to remark, that is triter and more plat than I believed it could be. Four, to the fact that a poem, help us, packed to bursting with words like purple, silver, green, egg white, red, heliotrope, gold, crimson, carmine, or even with phrases such as blue as a tip of a salvia blossom, does not make a poem full of colour any more than, as I used to think in error, a poem help us full of banjos, violins, cellos, viola da gambas and lutany makes a poem full of music. I'll leave a bit out. 5, that the tiger passage, so hectically praised, has the exact cadence of a great western goods yard under the defence of a realm notice concerning the undermentioned perambulators without babies in them, etc. So I don't know how much sense that last point makes if you're not reading it from a book, but what he's saying is that this person, Amy Lowell, as a poet, has a terrible ear and her language is actually very flat. And he goes on later to explain that the reason it's really got under his skin is she writes in free verse, you know, verse that doesn't have a regular rhyme or line length. And he says the problem is bad free verse looks very much like good free verse to start with, and therefore to people reading poetry it's going to cause confusion, like they're going to find it harder to recognize what's good about good free verse if there's this sort of rather rotten currency of bad verse going around. So the reason I've chosen all that at length is I think it brings out two things. One is the negative criticism, which, as I say, I mean, there is some of that in his published books as well, but not so much. And also the detailed criticism. So I'm sorry this is a very long answer, but if you read the history of literary criticism, I.A. Richards is always associated with a group of poets called critics called the New Poets. And what these textbooks of literary criticism always say is that the new critics were very detailed. Their criticism consisted of highly detailed readings, very close readings, detailed commentary on language. And in fact, I.A. Richards didn't write very much of that at all. There is very few pages where he actually comments in detail on a particular text of a poem or whatever. But actually in his letters, every now and then, you do find this very detailed, trenchant writing. So I think it slightly changes our picture of what kind of critic I.A. Richards was.
Okay, first of all, that was a very harsh criticism. I was like, wow, I wouldn't imagine anyone want to be born after they were criticized like this. Just on a side note, was that like directed to the poet? Like, was that a public letter that directed to the poet, or how does these letters work?
It's written to the woman who he married about and talking about the pamphlet that had been written by the friend of a woman who'd written to him. But because the pamphlet is about appreciation of Amy Lowell, he ends up talking about Amy Lowell's poetry. But I don't think there's any expectation that that would get back to Amy Lowell herself.
Okay, it got to the whole world now, so... Okay, so if I may kind of sum this up, so you think that, or we can find kind of in literature criticism a good example of letters that could, from your perspective, be considered as part of great literature. But if there's the only way,
there's probably more interest in Amy Lowell today than there was at the time, I think, because people have become much more interested in trying to assess the contribution of specifically female writers. And if a scholar today was researching Amy Lowell and the kind of reception she got, actually if they're unaware of this sort of commentary in people's letters and they're only sticking to things like essays published in journals, they're not going to get the full picture.
Interesting. Okay, any other examples, maybe a bit more positive, you may like to share with us?
Well, a lot of his letters are to a really famous poet of the time, T.S. Eliot. I find his letters, he treats Eliot with great respect. He obviously regards him as a sort of very serious intellect. And one of the interesting things is that there's a mixture of theory and practical criticism, applied criticism in his writing. I.A. Richards, although one of his most famous books is called Practical Criticism, he's actually best known for theoretical work, I think. But what's interesting in the letter for me is how the two rub side by side. Like, he starts talking about theoretical issues, and then he goes into some detailed comments on T.S. Eliot's own poetry, and the sort of the two belong together. You know, it's like he thinks you need both of them to think. So let me give an example. He talks about a recording that T.S. Eliot made of his poetry. And he said, "I should long ago have told you how I've liked The Hollow Men and Gerontion as they are recorded. Even the lines in which your reading comes with most surprise, as when you speed up rather than slow down, have very quickly become a great success. They seem now to be more an alternative mode of reaching the same result. It's all very puzzling. Now I've heard you reading them so often, I don't know how I should read them, or how near it would be to the way I used to read them before. But I feel confirmed in the view that sets of words are something much more complex and rich in their possibilities than any one utterance of them. That they are a matrix out of which great numbers of utterances may properly derive, and that possibly the difference between good utterances, as a collection of possibilities, and bad utterances, as another collection, is something like this. Good utterances don't conflict with one another, don't close down other possibilities in the same collection, but bad ones claim to be the only right ones, or alternatively have no sufficient form to be utterances at all. Now, this problem that a single line need have no right reading, yet will have innumerable wrong ones, but among all the many right ones, some at least will carry primarily very different interpretations, and that these interpretations, however different, are, if we allow for the factors that make them different, and do not take them as self-sufficient independent entities, which our lazy pragmatism does, parts or aspects or modes or phases or ways in the total meaning of the line itself, not as total meaning apprehensible, and yet that we must take some partial meaning and make it deputize for the whole, but without forgetting that we do so. This problem, which almost every sentence of good poetry presents to us, seems to me a paradigm for all the problems, big and little, of life and thought, which hasn't been translated into science. So I know this is very difficult to take in if I'm just reading it aloud, but actually in a way that's the point, because one of the interesting things here is you can kind of see him thinking on the page. I mean, the sentences sort of run away from him a bit, and one imagines, it's impossible to know this, but one imagines that's because he's having the ideas as he writes. He's trying to sort of capture his thinking on the wing. And we can see where his theory, the ideas he's enunciated there are sort of germs of ideas he explores in his theory. And we can see where the theory comes from. It's not just because he's interested in theory. It's because he's really been trying to make sense of T.S. Eliot's poems. That's what's prompted the theoretical discussion. And then he goes on to, from there, he goes on to discuss a passage or passages in a long work by T.S. Eliot called The Rock. And this is what he says about it. He says, "This seems my best way of saying that at various times I thought about the rock. Hearing it a second time, with your presence as a kind of orthochromatic screen, the prose scenes and the verse seem to me to fall apart, to become not merely on different planes, but actually discrepant. The prose profaning, where it touched the same matter, what was worthily handled in the verse. And where the verse condescended towards the prose, as in the Whipsnade line, I had the same jar, as if an angel were to back off from telling one how to live, to recommend woolen underwear." Okay, and so, again, we see this is negative criticism. Well, it's discriminating criticism. He's trying to pick out what he likes about the poem, and also what he doesn't like about it. And it's very, very forthright, isn't it? Like, and he's talking to the perhaps the greatest poet of his generation, and he's pretty damning about some of his writing. And it's characteristic that he's obviously very he's not afraid to criticize people. He's not one of those English people who says, oh, yes, I very much enjoyed your poems, Thomas. You know, very good, very interesting. He's prepared to say, do you know what? There's an awful lot wrong with your writing. And I think that's livelier and more vigorous than one would pick up from reading the sort of published literary criticism of the time, or probably of any time, really.
Well, that's fascinating. Two quick things just to follow up. Like, first, I'm not sure if that's the same for all his letters or all the letters that you have in mind when you think of them as formally literature. But it's kind of going back to the first point you said, between the fine line, on the fine line between private and public. When you were reading, it really seems very personal.
Yeah.
Yet the content makes it public in a way by virtue of it being a criticism that affects a public work. So it's kind of by virtue of criticizing a public work that makes it public, but the tone and the communication is more kind of a private one in a way. So this is something that I found quite fascinating in the experts you kindly shared with us. Maybe the second one is, to what extent do you think that there is, like, basically are all letters have to fit these very specific description of kind of commenting on a public work in a personal tone to have to raise to that or to fall into the category of grey literature, or this was just like one example that you found?
I think it's quite difficult. I would say, I would think his expectation was that the letters would be kept private. And it'd be interesting to know whether people writing an email work differently. In other words, if I, Richards, had been around while email was invented, would he have written differently? Because, of course, with email, it's so easy for people to forward your emails to other people. I mean, you really lose control of who's reading your text. Whereas with letters, it takes a bit of effort, doesn't it, to actually forward it to someone else. So I think that might affect things. I think he's incidentally, one of the really interesting things about this criticism is it's going on as the things are being written. In other words, he often comments about things that are not yet published and still being composed, and therefore he's trying to affect the way things are written. That's very interesting, and that's one of the explanations for he uses this quite harsh humour. Like he says, it sounds like an angel who's about to save our souls and then recommends that we wear woolen underwear. I think he uses humour because he wants to change the mind of the recipient, not just make a point. He actually wants to change the way that this person is writing. I think your second question, we ought to come back to that and explore it through a more than one podcast episode, because I don't think all letters count. Having argued that letters can be thought of as a form of grey literature, I don't think it follows that all letters are grey literature. You know, if I write you a letter and say, oh, by the way, I'll see you next week at the restaurant at 7 o'clock, that's not really grey literature. It's just a private communique. And I think inherent in your question there is this question about how you think about definitions, because there are various definitions of grey literature knocking around, but they all tend to take the same view, which is, well, we should be able to pinpoint something, take an example and say, yes, that's grey literature, or no, that isn't. And what I'm interested in is in the way in which things sort of become grey literature, might not be grey literature at some points, and may maybe become grey literature at others.
I think that's the last point is definitely very powerful. The idea of, like, not necessarily putting things in boxes, but rather treating each piece on its own grounds and then categorizing it. And it will be interesting to see, like, so if a letter fits into grey literature, then at least we have a category for it. But if it doesn't, it's still not like publication. It's not like, so it's not formal. It's not really literature. It's kind of something else, which is quite interesting to reflect on, indeed. Okay, so any final thoughts on this part of first episode on letters?
Well, since we've touched on this question of public and private, there's always a difficulty with letters, which is you don't really know definitively whether they were ever intended to be published, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So there are famous examples where you kind of feel like the writer was expecting them to be published, but you can't always. And in fact, perhaps in one of the later episodes, I'll give an example where the two people writing to each other, and one of the guys was a publisher, and he decided to then publish all the correspondence. And he said, I don't know whether the other writer, the interlocutor, I don't know whether he really expected them to be published or not. Like, I genuinely don't know whether they were intended for publication. So, and, you know, just because someone might say this is private or this is not, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. So it's really difficult to work out which. I mean, I've been reading some letters by Thomas Gainsborough, 18th century artist. And one of the interesting things in English literature is a lot of our best painters were very good letter writers. It's a very interesting thing. But reading the letters from Thomas Gainsborough, there's no way he would have envisaged them being published, because there wasn't the structure at the time. The publishing industry and the academic industry that underlies it, the publishing industry of that sort just didn't exist. So he had no reason to think that his letters would be published. And in a way, that kind of makes it more interesting, because there are some fresh insights that he perhaps hadn't fully thought out, and therefore didn't appear in more public discourse.
Fascinating. Wow. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Anthony, for such a big start on our theme of letters, and I definitely look forward to the next episode on the same theme from a different approach. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Inji. I hope I've conveyed. I think there's much more to be said on the theme of letters and in relation to grey literature, so very much look forward to returning to that theme. So thank you very much.
This was Inji Musa with Anthony Haynes. Grey Lad Cafe is edited by Dr. Bart Hallmark and produced by Frontinus Limited. Frontinus specializes in grey literature forms such as proposals, publications, papers, and reports. Frontinus helps creators of grey literature to achieve high-quality professional outputs and to be more productive. To discuss your grey literature needs and to see how Frontinus can help, you can contact Frontinus via their website, frontinus.org.uk. There is a link in the show notes. The music is from Handel's Water Music, courtesy of the United States Marine Band and Marine Chamber Orchestra.